Morning. In this week's Parsha, Parsha's Vayetze, in case anyone hasn't seen it yet, I'll ruin the ending for you. Yaakov Avinu gets married multiple times and has multiple children. The majority of the Shvatim are born in this week's Parsha, meaning all of the sons of Yaakov with the exception of Binyamin. Going forward, just a quick history of the 12 Shvatim. So Yaakov has these 12 sons. They eventually go down to Mitzrayim. At the time they go down to Mitzrayim, there are 70 of them. Okay, we're counting Yaakov at that point as well, so it's a little less than 70. 210 years later, we have now 600,000 men between the age of 20 and 60, meaning that there are millions of descendants of the Shvatim at that point. After they leave Mitzrayim, they spend some time in the desert. From there, they go into Israel, where they conquer the majority of the land of Israel during Sefer Yehoshua. They divide it during Sefer Shoftim, the living individually, more as Shvatim than as one nation. And there is no centralized government. In fact, the Shvatim come from almost all of the Shoftim come from almost all of the Shvatim. And that remains that way until the beginning of Sefer Shmuel, when the monarchy is introduced into Israel. For the first few years, it's from Shevet Binyamin, that being Shaul and Ishbosheth. After that, David HaMelech becomes the king, and from that point on, we have the Malchus Beis David. We have a centralized government coming out of Shevet Yehuda. The Malchus Beis David, unfortunately, is somewhat short-lived in its full glory. David HaMelech is the king, his son Shlomo is the king, but shortly thereafter, when it comes time for Shlomo's son Rehoboam to take over, things are not going quite that well. In fact, Achya HaShiloni, who is a Navi at the time, comes over to Yerovam ben Nevat and says to him, because Shlomo did not actually act the way that he was supposed to, God has made a decision that he's going to divide the land, the nation of Israel. David HaMelech and his family will remain kings only over Shevet Yehuda and Binyamin, and all of the other Shvatim will become a separate country. The Aseres HaShvatim and Yerovam ben Nevat will take over it. That is the first of the Makoros. That's at the end of Perek Yud Aleph in Sefer Melachim. However, that's also very short-lived, because by Perek Yudalad, less than three parakim later, Achya HaShiloni comes back to Yerovam and says to him, because you, in fact, have been much worse. In fact, Achya HaShiloni tells Yerovam that his actions, including that he built Batei Avodah Zarah, it seems that Yerovam was under the impression that were the people to keep on going to the Beis HaMikdash and see that there was a king of Yehuda, which had the Beis HaMikdash, that would threaten his power. Therefore, he stopped the people from making Aliyah L'Regel, stopped them from going to Yerushalayim on the Yom Tovim, instead had other Yom Tovim and other Beis Mikdashes that he had the people go to. Obviously, this does not make God happy. And God tells him at that point that we're going to break off, that the ten Shvatim that have broken off from Malchus Beis David eventually will be thrown out of the land of Israel and destroyed. And it takes just a few hundred years until Malachim Beis, when in fact we read that. Looking at the third Makor, B'shnas Chamishim V'shtayim Shonar Azariah Melch Yehuda, Melch Pekach Bar Ramal Yoh Al Yisrael B'shomram Esrim Shonar. So it was the 20th year of the king of Pekach Ben Ramal Yoh, who is the king of Israel. He too kept on doing the same averus, the same sins that were done by all of the previous Malchi Yisrael. B'mei Pekach Melch Yisrael bot Tiglas Pleser Melch Ashur v'yikach es Iyun v'es Evel b'is Ma'acho v'es Yanuach v'es Kedesh v'es Chatzor v'es Gilad v'es Gliro kol Eretz Naphtali v'yagrei Mashura. At this point, a large part of Israel, meaning the Eivar Yarden and some of the northern territories, are taken over by Ashur, Assyria, and with that they are sent into exile. Shortly thereafter, the rest of the Aseres HaShvatim follow, and they also go into exile as well. If you take a look at number four, Vayibishas Revius Melchizkio, He Ashanar Shvius Lahoshea Ben Ela Melch Yisrael, Allah Shalmaneser Melch Ashur, Al Shomron Vayat Saraleha. And it was a few years later that the king of Ashur again comes down to attack Israel, and he in fact is once again successful. Vayokadua Mikseh Shalosh Shanim Bishanah Shesh Lechizkio, Hishnas Teshel Hoshea Ben Melch Yisrael, Milkad Shomron. After 3 years, Shomron, the capital of the land of Yisrael, of the Ten Shvatim, falls. Vayago Melch Ashur es Yisrael Ashur Vayanchim Bachachach Vachavor Nahar Gozen Varmadai. And we are told where they are sent to. They are sent to places called Chachach, Chavor, the river of Gozen, and the cities of Madai. And God explains why. So that is the end of the Aseres HaShevatim. And of course, if you read on in Malachim Beis, eventually, shortly, a few years later, Ashur attacks Yehuda. Miraculously, they are saved. However, afterwards, when Babel attacks, the first Beis HaMikdash is destroyed, and Yehuda also goes into Galus. However, there's a major difference between the Galus of the Ten Shvatim and the Galus of Yehuda. After Yehuda goes into exile, so we read about the exile in the book of Esther, for example. Afterwards, in Ezra and Nehemiah, we read about how they come back. Chagei Zechariah and Malachi discuss how eventually the Galus of Babel is returned to Israel, and the second Beis HaMikdash is built. However, as far as the Galus of the Ten Shvatim, the silence is deafening. There is no discussion of them from this point onwards. One would have to dig very hard into the rest of Tanakh to find even a mention of the Ten Shvatim afterwards. Unlike the Shvatim of Yehuda and Binyamin, who we hear all about them, their history keeps on going. The history of the majority of Israel. The ten tribes are literally lost. We don't hear from them again. And the question becomes, whatever happened to these ten tribes? Why don't we hear about them anymore? Are they here anymore? The Mishnah in the Sanhedrin raises the issue. And there is a machlokes, whatever became of these ten tribes? The Mishnah starts by saying, Aseres HaShvatim Einam Nachzinum Lachzor. The ten tribes are never coming back. Shenemar, Vayashlichem El Eretz Acheres Kayom Hazeh. It quotes a pasuk in Nitzavim, which says that they will be sent to a different land like this day. It's a very strange pasuk. You can't have a place and a time being similar. The place was so beautiful, it was like Tuesday. It doesn't work out that way. Being sent to an Eretz Acheres, to another land, like today, what does that mean? So the Mishnah explains, Mahayom Holech Veino Chozer. Just like today, when it's gone, it's never coming back. Afheim Hochim Veim Chozrim. They too, once they have gone, they are not coming back. Divrei Rabbi Akiva. This is the opinion of Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Elezer Omer, Kayom Hazeh. No, you have a wrong drasha. When it says Kayom Hazeh, that they're going to go into Golos like this day, it doesn't mean just like today is gone and it's never coming back. So too they are gone and they are never coming back. But rather, Ma Yom HaMa'afil Meir, just like the day gets dark and then becomes light again, Afaser HaShvatim Sha'afilu Lehem Kein Asir Lehem. Just like things got very dark for the ten tribes, ultimately will become light again. Meaning that he disagrees with Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva is of the opinion that we will never see the Aseres HaShvatim again. That's a very strong statement. Because if we look around this room, I think, where do we come from? So some of us are descendants of Arkanim or Leviim. So we know what Shevet you're from. Some of us someplace along are descendants of Gerim. But beyond that, what are the options? According to the opinion of Rabbi Akiva, everybody else is either from Yehuda or Binyamin. Because all of the other options have been wiped out. As opposed to the second opinion, The opinion of Rabbi Eliezer, he says no, that anybody can be from every shevet. Yes, things look bad for them, but things bounce back. The Gemara discusses this a little bit more afterwards, and in fact also discusses whether or not these 10 shvatim got to go to Olam Haba. Now, of course, this is, besides everything else, a historically important question. And we have to make a decision at some point. What do we think is right? Rashi mentions that even the diarists of opinions here, the opinion of Rabbi Akiva is a pretty big opinion, you don't want to mess with him, points out that there was some return. If you look at Rashi there at number 6, Eina sidim lachzor mimakom shagolum. Hadaminu begemar b'diyirmiya hechziron lo shehechziron kulon elamik sasam hechziron. Rashi points out that there is a Gemara in Megillah, which is number 7 here. We'll do it outside. The Gemara in Megillah discusses, so there comes a point in Malachim Beis. Again, if anyone ever learns Malachim, particularly Malachim Beis, it's a very depressing sefer. Things just kind of go downhill through the entirety. Right, one king after another king, one's worse than the last one. However, there were a few bright spots, and one of the bright spots was King Yoshiyahu. And it tells the story that during his time they found a Sefer Torah. And they needed someone. How far they had fallen, this pshat is that they couldn't even find someone who knew how to read a Sefer Torah. They'd never seen one. So they went to Chulda HaNeviyah. It was a woman who was a Navi, and they brought it to her, and she read it, and she taught them, and this began a tremendous Baal Tshuva movement. So the Gemara asked, why did they go to Chulda? Yirmiyah HaNavi was alive at the same time. Go to Yirmiyah. So the answer is that Yirmiyah wasn't there at the time. Where was Yirmiyah? So the Gemara in Megillah tells us that Yirmiyah had gone to bring back the Ten Shvatim. And in fact, there are psukim later on, which seems to indicate that the 10 Shvatim did come back. So Rashi says, yes, the 10 Shvatim came back. Some of them came back. Yirmiyah, how many people was he going to bring back? Yirmiyah brought back a handful of people, but that was only temporary. According to the opinion of Rabbi Akiva, ultimately, they all died out. The Gemara talks about it from time to time. It's interesting. The yeshiva is doing Maseches Yevamos, so we'll just quote a Gemara in Yevamos. If you look at number 8, Amar Rabbi Yehuda, Amar Rabbi Asi, Oik Chom Shekidush Bezman Hazem, Choshim Kedushin. If a Jew cannot marry a non-Jew, right? There are certain people that are not allowed to get married. For example, a Kohen is not allowed to marry a divorced woman. However, in the event that a Kohen does go over to a divorced woman and give her a ring in front of two Edom and say, Harei at mekudeshes liba tabazu, they are married. She is an Eshes Ish. However, if a man goes over to another man and says, Harei at mekudash liba tabazu, they are not married. That doesn't work. No matter what, they're both welcome to marry any woman they want afterwards. Not to worry about, there's no issues of adultery at this point. Similarly, what if a non-Jew marries a Jew? The standard opinion is that doesn't work either. If a non-Jewish man goes over to a woman and says, Harei mekudeshesli, with a ring, she's welcome to marry whoever she wants afterwards. So the Gemara raises the possibility, well, how do you know he's not Jewish? Maybe he's from the 10 Shvatim. These 10 Shvatim that somehow got mixed into everybody else, maybe they're still out there. So what do we do with this? So the bottom line is that there are certain rules. Right? Among the rules out there is that if there's a machokes between Rabbi Akiva and another opinion, Rabbi Akiva always wins. Machokes, Rabbi Akiva, v'chaveiro, halacha k'Rabbi Akiva. So here we have a machokes between Rabbi Akiva and one of his friends. If we would apply that rule, we would have to follow the opinion of Rabbi Akiva, and we'd have to go on the assumption that all of the 10 Shvatim are lost. The Rambam is aware of that. Therefore, in the Pirush HaMishnayos, in his commentary on the Mishnah, the Rambam says that we should know something, a special rule that we might not have mentioned until now. The Rambam says, number 9, Aser HaShvatim Einon Asinim Lachzor. The 10 Shvatim are not coming back. Shenamon, etc. Kfar Zechatir HaPamim Rabos. The Rambam says, I mentioned this several times already. Shekol machloka sheyia bein hachachamim sheino bo lidei maisa elo shu emunas dover bovad ein tzad livsok halacha keechad mehem. Whatever you have a machlokes, that's not a practical machlokes. That there's nothing you're going to do based on it. Right? You have a machlokes. Let's say this morning you forgot Yalav Yevo. Today's Rosh Chodesh, as was announced beforehand. So, if I forget Yalav Yevo, there's a machlokes, what I do, you have to make a decision. You can do one or the other. But there are certain things out there where there are discussions and there are disagreements where it doesn't really matter. For example, the age of the universe. People get very excited about this. On the one hand, we have a tradition that the universe is 5,772 years old. Science points to numbers that are much, much higher, into the billions. Right? So some people say that, no, we remain literalists, and we reject science. And we say that carbon dating isn't worth anything, and we don't believe in the expanding universe, and whatever answers you're going to give. Other people say, no, in fact, science is correct. And when we talk about the 6 days of creation, that's not literal. And in fact, we accept science. So who's right? Who do we paskin like? So the Rambam says, we don't. What do you have to paskin? What's the difference? Does it make a difference what I'm going to have for breakfast this morning, whether the earth is 5,000 years old or 15 billion years old? There's no difference. Well, there's a case where there's no difference. Well, how are you going to have a gift? If a man goes over to a woman and says, Hareyat Mekudeshesli, we're going to be married on the condition the earth is 5,772 years old. Now we have to determine how old it is. Nah, it doesn't come up so much, hopefully. Right? Bottom line is, there's so many things out there which are very interesting, very fascinating questions out there, things that we're very curious about. It's a mitzvah of Talmud Torah to try to figure it out. But ultimately, there's no real practical difference if it's one way or the other. So the Rambam tells us, when we talk about paskening, making a decision that we follow Rabbi Akiva, you can only talk about that if there's a practical ramification. There is no practical ramification here, and therefore the rule that we follow Rabbi Akiva does not apply. Yes? The question was as follows. She wanted to know, what do you mean there's no practical ramification? Didn't we say here that there is a possible... So one could answer that question without getting to this. You can talk and say, even... Let's say the 10 Shvatim are still around. What are the odds that this guy is from the 10 Shvatim? The majority of non-Jews are not from the 10 Shvatim. Right? The overwhelming majority probably are not, even if it is so. So therefore you don't have to, right? Therefore you can follow the road. You don't have to get into the question. Well, get to Ethiopia. Okay. I won't talk to them. Okay, so that is the first approach. The first approach says that, yes, technically, if this was a halachic question, we would have to follow Rabbi Akiva, but this isn't a halachic question. This is a question that has no practical ramifications, and therefore we don't have to take an opinion. The Pachad Yitzchak, not Rav Huttner, the other one, also writes that he has every reason to believe that even if we would follow the general rules of Psak, not like the Rambam, we still wouldn't follow Rabbi Akiva. Why? Well, he gives multiple answers, which are available if you'd like to look at number 10. But among them are, as far as the Mishnah goes, there's one person who disagrees with Rabbi Akiva. If you read the Gemara, there are other opinions. So the rule is, halacha k'Rabbi Akiva mechaveiro. We follow Rabbi Akiva when he disagrees with one opinion, however, not mechaveiro. However, when there are multiple opinions that disagree with Rabbi Akiva, we do not follow Rabbi Akiva. So that's another approach. However, the majority of the people who discuss this question in terms of practicality point to the fact that Rabbi Akiva probably can't follow Rabbi Akiva either. How's that? So if you look at number 11, it's a Perek in Yecheskel, and it's Haftarah even. It says as follows. Yecheskel was given a nevuah. And it says as follows. Daber aleihem. Ko amar Adonai Elohim. Hine ani okeach es eitz Yosef asher biyad Ephraim. V'shifte Yisrael chaveirav. V'nasati osom olav es eitz Yehuda. V'asisem le'eitz echad v'hoyu echad biyadi. So he said, take two pieces of wood. On one piece of wood, write that this is the eitz Yosef. This piece of wood represents the 10 Shvatim. And on the other piece of wood, write that this is Yehuda, representing the other Shvatim. And he is told, hold these pieces of wood together and they will become one. And the Nevuah goes on to explain what this means, that even though at this point there has been a separation, even though at this point Yehuda and Yosef, the ten Shvatim and the Malchus Yehuda have been separated, ultimately in time they will come back together. Similarly, Yechezkel in Perek Mem Zayin, which is number 12 on the source sheet, says, Ko amar Adonai Elohim, Gei Gavul Asher Tiznachu Es Eretz Mishnei Masor Shifte Yisrael Yosef Chavalim. Yechezkel, it is generally assumed, is talking about the time of the third Beis HaMikdash. And Yechezkel says, when it comes time for a redivision of the land of Israel in the time of the Mashiach, the land of Israel will be divided into 12 portions. Both of these Nevuahs clearly assume that in the time of Mashiach, all of the Shvatim will be with us. Therefore, how could Rabbi Akiva be of the opinion that the 10 Shvatim have been lost and they're not coming back? Rabbi Akiva cannot disagree with a Nevuah. And Yechezkel HaNavi says very clearly that in the time of the Bayis Shlishi, all of the Shvatim will be together. In fact, if you look at the Chidushei Haran on the Gemara in Sanhedrin, number 13, he clearly says that the opinion of Rabbi Akiva cannot be taken literally that they won't come back ever, but rather one has to limit the opinion of Rabbi Akiva to only the actual people that went into Golos. Those people all died in Golos. They never got to come back. However, later generations, of course, did come back. That is the opinion of the Ran, and that is the opinion of the majority of the Rishonim. The Rishonim do not see how it could be that Rabbi Akiva could disagree with Psukim. Now, it's interesting to note, the Sefer HaIkarim does have an interesting approach. The Sefer HaIkarim raises this issue, and based on the issue, says that obviously Rabbi Akiva must be of the opinion that the Nevuah of Yechezkel is not referring to later times, not referring to the third Beis HaMikdash, but rather is referring to the second Beis HaMikdash. The Sefer HaIkarim of Yosef Albo is of the opinion that Yechezkel is just saying that some will come back for the second Beis HaMikdash, but Rabbi Akiva, who comes afterwards, says after that they are gone and they're never coming back. That is a minority opinion. In fact, the Abarbanel writes very strongly against that, and he gives many, many reasons to show that we cannot be accepting of the opinion that Yechezkel is talking about anything but the third Beis HaMikdash. So therefore, ultimately, at the end of the day, the overwhelming majority of the opinions reject. Either they reject Rabbi Akiva's opinion, or they reinterpret Rabbi Akiva's opinion, and therefore we are of the opinion that the ten Shvatim are not totally lost, but rather, somewhere out there in the world, the ten Shvatim still exist. And that, of course, opens up the major issue of where are they? It's worth noting that this is such a major issue, the discussion of where are the ten Shvatim, that the Library of Congress has an entire section dedicated just to this study. You go to the library, you look at DS, I think it's 123 or so, shelves and shelves of books of people just looking for the Ten Shvatim. Not just Jews. In fact, overwhelmingly not Jews. One of the key parts of Christian theology is that in order for the ultimate Messiah to come, we require everybody to come back. They require Kibbutz Goliath as well. And therefore, for hundreds and hundreds of years now, they too have been looking, in fact, probably harder than we've been looking for the lost tribes. And the question is, what type of hints do we have? What do we have to go on? Where would they be? So if you look at Rashi, so again, as we mentioned earlier, the Pesukim gives names of places, Chachach, Chavur, which we don't really know where they are. Rashi gives us a little bit more of a hint. Look at number 14. Masashu kulam golem memokam echad el eretz acheres. He said, the simple understanding of the Pesukim is that the entire ten Shvatim were taken from one place, meaning the land of Israel, and then moved to a second place. So when Sancheirov took them into Gauls, where did he bring them? Afriki. What does Afriki sound an awful lot like? Africa. That's what it seems. Aval shnei ha-shvatim lo galu l'makom echad. However, the last two shvatim were not sent to one place altogether. Oh, this pasuk b'chol ha-ratzos, they were spread out. So, according to the opinion of Rashi, Rashi talks about the fact that the ten shvatim were ultimately sent, so as you know, Sancheirov. Sancheirov was the king of Ashur. We happen to know an awful lot about Sancheirov. It's very interesting. If you ever take a trip down to Metropolitan Museum of Art, they have a fair amount of archaeology items that are related to Sancheirov himself, and a lot of it is related to Sancheirov and his attack on Israel. Sancheirov had a very successful attack, unfortunately, on the city of Lachish, which was a major city in Yehuda, actually not in Yehuda, in the more northern part of Israel. There are, in fact, I think it's in the Metropolitan Museum of Art now, they have actual frescoes, the pictures from the time of the Jews being led away, and afterwards, I'm sure most people are familiar with Sancheirov attacks Yerushalayim in the time of Chizkiah, and miraculously the Jews are saved. It's very interesting. There's something which I believe is the British Museum called the Sancheirov Cylinder. That there is a cylinder which on it is written the history of Sancheirov as told by Sancheirov. And in this cylinder, there is a discussion. He discusses how he conquered Lachish, like we have in the Tanakh. And then he goes on to discuss the battle against Yerushalayim. And he writes that he has surrounded Yerushalayim. He has it caught like a bird in a cage. He's about to crush it. And then it ends. Which is very interesting how that is also the way we have it. Obviously, he doesn't want to write in his autobiography how he got crushed miraculously. But it just ends at that point. So Sancheirov was best known for his policy of when he would attack a country, when he would take over, he would do displacement. He would move the populations from one point to another point so they wouldn't feel comfortable. So Sancheirov, according to Rashi, took the Aseres HaShvatim and they got moved to Afriki. That's one thing we know. The Midrashim talk a lot about the fact that they were brought to the dark hills beyond the river Sambatyon. Right? The Sambatyon, according to different Midrashim, is this miraculous river which cannot be crossed. The river Sambatyon goes 6 days a week. It takes Shabbos off, hence the name Sambatyon. Miraculous stories, and that's what we're looking for. This is the. These are the hints that we have for the Aseres HaShvatim. And over the years, many rumors came up. The most famous of the stories of the Aseres HaShvatim is the story of Eldad Hadani. The Otzer Midrashim has a very long version of this. There was a book written by this fellow, Eldad Hadani, which was one of the first books ever to be published at the time that they invented publishing printing because it was so popular. Just giving you the beginning of the story in number 15. Noda Adonainu ki nisra beinenu adam echad, ushmolt Eldad Hadani mishevatan. A fellow once showed up here and his name was Eldad Hadani, and as the name would indicate, he came from Shevet Dan. Vasipra lanu ki arba shvatam heim b'machkam echad. And he told us that four of the Shvatim are in one place. Don v'Naftali, Gad v'Asher. Shema makom Chavila, Hakaduma Asher, Sham HaZahav. They were in Chavila, that is where the gold is found. V'Yishrem Shofet, Avdun Shemo. They have a Shofet, that's his name. V'Adonim Arba Misos, Bezdim, V'Yoshim, V'Olim, V'Nosim, V'Chonim, V'Makom, V'Makom. And they in fact follow the Torah. They still do the Arba Misos, Bezdim, that which we don't do. And they move from place to place. They're constantly fighting with the five kings of Cush. And their land is so wide it would take 7 months to walk it. However, they're surrounded on three sides by these kings and they're constantly fighting with them. So whoever is strong becomes warriors and fights these constant wars, and everyone else sits in kolo. Yeshem ha-mikra kol kula, they have the entire Tanakh. Ve'en kolo Megillah v'maisa Esther. However, they do not have Megillah's Esther. Well, that makes sense, because assuming that they went into Golus at the time of the, before the destruction of the Bayis Rishon, obviously they also had, they do not have Megillah's Esther, which historically had not happened yet. Goyim also an ace, below Megillah's Eichon. Similarly, they weren't there for the destruction of Beis HaMikdash, they did not have Eichon. Kedei shelo l'shamer es liba. It would be too depressing for them. They have a Mishnah, like we have. However, unlike us who have the opinions of the Tanoim who lived later on, every single halacha they have, it says, Yahushua said them in the Moshe in the name of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So that was the story that this Eldad Hadani told. And this Eldad Hadani went around to various communities in Europe, and the general assumption was that they accepted him as being a true member of the 10 lost tribes. They sent a shayla to Rav Tzemach Gon at the time, and Rav Tzemach Gon said that, yeah, I have every reason to believe him, that this man is telling the truth, that Eldad Hadani is a representative of the 10 Shvatim, and we should do whatever we can to get them back. How accepted was Eldad Hadani? It's very interesting. If you open up the Gemara in Chulin, the very first Mishnah in Chulin says, HaKol Shochtim, that everyone can be a Shochet. So Tosfos asks, everyone, does that include women? Can women be Shochtim? So he quotes, number 16, Kasa Behilchos Eretz Yisrael. It's written in the Hilchos Eretz Yisrael, women should not be shochtim. Why should datum kalos? Ve'nira, and Tosfos says it doesn't seem to be right. Not only can women shecht a regular chicken or cow, even karbonos women can shecht. So Tosfos says, I don't know where this comes from. And the basic question that you have to ask is, what is the Hilchos Eretz Yisrael? Who ever heard of Hilchos Eretz Yisrael before? They have it in the Svarim Psalms. What is this Hilchos Eretz Yisrael? So the Mordechai tips us off. And he says as follows. Kosev Rabbeinu Baruch, where Isi HaKosev B'Hilchos Shechita Shevi, Rabbi Eldon ben Machri, Haba Me'asaras HaShvatim. So he says, what this is, it's from the fellow named Eldon ben Machri, who's from the Asaras HaShvatim, more popularly known as Eldad Hadani. And he quotes all sorts of halachas that a person is supposed to do. In his sefer, of the halachas that he says that is the traditions of the Ten Shvatim, it says that women should not shecht. However, besides that, it says many other interesting things. Right? It talks about the amount of kavana a person has to have. So the Mordechai says that's against our Gemara. We assume that there's no kavana you really need. Most problemsome is that among the halachas he has is that Eldad Hadani says when a person shechts an animal, they're supposed to face Yerushalayim when they do that. That is a halacha not only aren't we familiar with, but it is a halacha that other people are familiar with. Namely the Muslims. When you shecht halal meat, you're supposed to turn towards Mecca and shecht the animal. So this halacha that you're supposed to face Yerushalayim sure sounds that Eldad Hadani got confused with another religion. And therefore that really raises the issue as to all of these traditions that he has, how true are they? One, a lot of scholars talk about the fact maybe he was a fraud. But even if he wasn't a fraud, just because he thinks he's part of the Shvatim, just because he thinks that these are the halachas, what does that mean? So therefore, there are definite issues that come up with this fellow Eldad Hadani. If you look at the Ibn Ezra in Pasha Shmos, the Ibn Ezra flat out says that this is false, that one has to reject the opinions of Eldad Hadani, there is no Masorah on it, we have no reason to believe that anything that Eldad Hadani said was ever true. Now, this issue of Eldad Hadani died down for many years until the 1970s. And now we get to Ethiopia. At some point in the 70s, there is a tremendous famine. People are fleeing, are streaming out of Ethiopia. And among them are many people who are claimed that they are the descendants of Eldad Hadani. And as they are descendants of Eldad Hadani, they are members of the 10 tribes, and they would like to move to Israel. They would like to go to Israel under the law of return. And the question becomes, to what extent do we believe that which they are saying? Rav Avadi Yosef, yes. So again, the major opinion that accepted it was the Radvaz in the 15th century, right? Which is long before. The Radvaz has a series of questions, two or three of them, where he asked interesting questions. For example, a member of the Egyptian community sends him a question that they were at a slave trade, and one of the slaves said that they are a descendant of the 10 tribes. This person wants the Radvaz to answer whether there is a mitzvah of pidyon shvuyim, whether there is a requirement for him to buy this slave and let them go free. And the Radvaz says yes. He accepts that they are from the 10 tribes. Now, when the modern day Ethiopian question comes up, Rav Avadi Yosef comes forward and he says that absolutely, positively, they are from the 10 tribes. And he bases it on the sources. The sources say, the Radvaz, etc., that there has been an acceptance that these are from the 10 tribes. And therefore, Rav Avadya says, we have no reason to doubt anything that was said. Since we have no reason to doubt it, therefore Rav Avadya was ready to accept them straight out as Jews. They do not require a conversion. They are absolutely Jewish, and they should be welcomed into the land of Israel. Rav Avadya's opinion was not the majority opinion. Of Herzog, of Waldenberg, the Tzitz Eliezer. I think we have on the sheet here of Moshe Feinstein, if you look at number 19. All were of the opinion that one has to really wonder as to whether this is true or not. For example, there are several issues that we have out here. The first issue that we have to deal with is, are they or are they not? Let's start with Eldad Hadani. Eldad Hadani, we're not so sure that he's for real. Now the question is, why is he not for real, if he's not for real? Is it that he made up the story himself? Could it be that they, on their own, became of the opinion that they were Jewish, and in fact it was never true? So that's problem number one. Problem number two is, even if they were Jewish, they've been living out in Africa, unattached to the rest of the Jewish world now, for many centuries. How do we know how much intermarriage has been going on? Have they been accepting converts? If so, what type of gerus were they doing? If their gerus does not match our gerus, their converts were not converts, and therefore there's a fair amount of non-Jews. Perhaps even more problematic than the possibility that they're not Jews is the possibility that they are Jews. Why is that problematic? Because as we said, their halachas do not match ours. And their gittin, their form of divorce, is not what we have. Now, in terms of getting married, it's not very hard to do. If a man gets into a woman with the intention of getting married, and two people who are observant see it, they are married. However, getting divorced is much more complicated. It involves a very specific document that has to be written in a very specific way and given over in a very specific way. Given that we're talking of hundreds and thousands of years at this point, right? From the time of that the Ten Shvatim went into Golus until now is almost 2,500 years. How many people were the product of second marriages? Assuming that their kedushin, their marriage, is a good marriage, and their gittin, their divorce, is not a halachically valid divorce, well, they are mamzerim, correct? And if the event that we would get up and say these people are not Jewish, well, we could fix that. If we say that they are Jewish and they are suffek, potentially mamzerim, there's not a lot we can do to help them. So Rav Moshe Feinstein was of the opinion that he was not convinced that they were Jewish, and he said, Lekula, he will be lenient and assume that they are not Jewish, and that leniency will allow them to convert and get married to anybody else. The decision of the Israeli government was to accept all of the Ethiopians without conversion. However, to encourage those who were interested to convert. I heard a rumor, I have no backing for these numbers whatsoever, but what I had heard is around 20% of them converted afterwards. But that's an issue. A person has to keep in mind that even though we accept the Ethiopians into Israel, that is following the opinion of Rav Avadia Yosef that they are undeniably Jewish and there is no issues whatsoever. Majority, perhaps, of the opinions, and of the opinion of Moshe Feinstein, as shown here, is that we assume that there are issues and perhaps they are not Jewish, and in the event that a person would like to marry, one should be careful to try to do a gerus l'chumrah, right? It could be that they are Jewish, it could be they're not Jewish, it's better to be safe about it. Rav Shechter wrote an article on it, which appears here as number 20, at least part of it, and he says that he thinks that we can be makel on the mamzerus question, we can be lenient on the question of their mamzer, based on what's called a sveik sveik, a double suffix. As we said, he said, given any single individual, there are two issues. Maybe they're Jewish, maybe they're not Jewish. If they're not Jewish, they're definitely not a mamzer. If they are Jewish, well, maybe they are descendants of a second marriage, maybe they are not descendants of a second marriage. So, since they, even though we are machmir, we are very careful not to allow someone who is a suffic mamzer to marry into regular Klal Yisrael. A sveik sveika, we are makel. If it's a double suffic, we can be makel. But Rav Shechter comments that to the extent possible, one has to look into the facts. Looking at the last line of the article, the essay makes no pretensions to actual psak. Said, I'm not answering the question. For a practical conclusion to be reached, all the relevant facts have to be determined and considered. Said, to the extent possible, a person has to dig and dig and see, is it true? Can we prove these people? Are they descendants of the Ten Shvatim or not? In response to Rav Shechter's article, there was an article written by Karen Bacon, the Dean of Stern College for Women. In the Torah Modern Journal, Volume 3, Dean Bacon, beyond being a wonderful dean, also has a PhD in biology from UCLA, and she uses her background to do a DNA analysis of the Ethiopian community. I don't know much about this, but my understanding is, whatever I know is through Ishto Kagufo, is that the person, is that there is certain similarities in the genetic makeup of Jews all around the world, and upon checking the DNA of this community, it seemed that their DNA was much more common to the local African tribes than it is to the Jewish people. So obviously, that itself is not an answer, but Dean Bacon says this is very helpful to Rabbi Shechter, because that is a way of showing that in all likelihood, and this isn't enough to pass on its own, that there is strong support that in fact that they were not Jewish, and since they are not Jewish, we do not have to worry about the issues of mamzer. It is fascinating over the years just to read about this, there are some good books on it if you're interested, as to who are the potential 10 tribes. There's hardly a country in the world that doesn't take some claim for the 10 tribes. Right? Japan, for example, is very high on being one of the 10 tribes. Right? If you go to South America, many people there in the Amazon claim to be members of the 10 tribe. Africa, it goes without saying. Afghanistan, for sure. Native Americans, correct. It's very interesting. Thomas Jefferson wrote a piece where he argued against the fact that the Native Americans were the 10 lost tribes. It was so common in the days of the early settlers that Thomas Jefferson, the photo of the Oxmo, had to write a shtickel Torah why he thought that it wasn't right. Among the other interesting stories, there's a story in the early 20th century, there was a fellow from Boston, an Orthodox Jew, who became convinced that the Boxer Rebellion, Right? The Boxer Rebellion, for those who aren't familiar, is that in China they had this cult like that was going around killing foreigners and Christians in particular. And eventually England and America had to send troops out there to help put down the rebellion. At the time, this fellow went to, his name was Haga, went to the president, McKinley, and begged, "Please allow me to go with the troops, because I have every reason to believe that these are the 10 lost tribes, and I'll be able to get through to them." In fact, McKinley not only allowed him to go, but actually paid his way for this firm yid to go along. He got one letter back to his family saying that he's convinced this is it, and he was killed shortly thereafter, unfortunately, and it seems he probably wasn't right. But there's this tremendous fascination with the 10 tribes. Again, Afghanistan to this day, there's a lot of talk about it. And the British Empire, at one point, there were hundreds of thousands of people who were supporting the idea that they were from the 10 lost tribes. The proof being, look how much they've taken over. Just so we'll discuss before we end for a few questions, the only other one that's really worth spending any time on are the B'nai Menashe. In India, there are these people who claim to be descendants of Menashe, the B'nai Menashe, and they have begun to move to Israel as well. There is a discussion as to whether or not this is accepted. In, I think, 2005, there was an article in Haaretz and on Arut Sheva, which said that Rav Amar, the Rishon LeZion, Paskin, that the B'nai Menashe are in fact from the 10 lost tribes, and based on that he's sending out a bunch of Rabbanim to India to convert them and bring them back. Now the article itself didn't make so much sense. One of the basic rules of Geirus is we aren't Megayer Jews. If they are Jewish, why are we sending out people to convert them? That is the most basic question. So I figured, well, you know, the Haaretz isn't exactly a primary source. Rav Amar has tshuvas. I'll go look up the tshuva and see what it actually says. Could be that someone got it confused. So, in fact, Rav Amar in his tshuvas has no mention of this. Places, journals like Tchumen, where he usually publishes, also had no mention of this. Other tshuvas have, no one has any mention of that this was ever said. Finally, a year later, if you look, there was an article on the internet, ladat.net, where Rav Amar is interviewed, and he said, "I never said it." So the whole article in Haaretz wasn't true. He said, "What I said was, I am not convinced they're Jewish, therefore, if they want to come, we will send Rabbanim to convert them. But we are not convinced, in fact, that they are Jewish. You know, if in fact they are Shomer Torah mitzvahs, then we're willing to work with them, but not more than that." So this question remains. What comes to the maskana, the bottom line is, we probably believe that the Aseres HaShvatim are out there somewhere. We believe that soon enough Mashiach will come. Every day in Shemona Esrei we daven for Kibbutz Golias. That will bring them all back. However, to say that there is any group out there that we are convinced are from the Aseres HaShvatim, I don't think there's anyone out there that we are convinced at this point. We'll now take a few questions. Yes. Because even before Rabbeinu Gershon, a woman couldn't have two husbands. No, it wasn't men having more. After the issue has nothing to do with men. Could have, even nowadays, if a man goes and has many wives, we don't support it. We don't think it's a good idea. Right? It's also, however, children will not be mamzerim. Correct. Children are only mamzerim if a woman has more than one husband. So if a get is no good and then the woman gets remarried, that's the issue. So it's unrelated to the Rabbeinu Gershon issue. That is correct. Just like nowadays, in the event that a couple gets divorced without a get, if the woman gets remarried and has children, those children are mamzerim. If the man gets remarried and has children, those children are not mamzerim. That's true. However, you have the case of the women getting remarried. Yes. So again, I am not an expert of the various communities, But to the extent that they have found that the Jews of Majorca are descendants of Jews, and they have a tradition, etc. Remember, the Jews of Majorca, my understanding is that their Judaism is very similar to ours. Right? The Judaism of the Jews of Ethiopia is very different than our Judaism. And therefore, one has to wonder to what extent were there foreign influences, or was this, you remember, the original, you know, Christianity started out as a Jewish religion also. You know, it could be that among the theories out there was that Christian missionaries converted these tribes, and they themselves began to believe that they were from the Jews now. India? We're talking about B'nai Menashe now? Okay. Okay, but that doesn't answer the possibility for intermarriage. Eldar Adani lived, I think, in the 1100s. Kurdish Jews, there was a very strong belief at one point that the Kurdish Jews were also from the Ten Shvatim. There are books written on that. I mean, anyone who's that interested, I think ultimately that belief fell off. My impression is that, you know, that whatever reason they believed it, there were at the end there were reasons not to accept it. It's very interesting. There are many, many books. If Hillel Halkin has Beyond what? I mean, you just go. Right, just go to the library. You know, Rivka Gonen wrote a nice book on it. Gonen, G-O-N-E-N. Mm-hmm. Right, she has a nice, simple English, easy to read book on it. If you want one case in particular, Hillel Halkin has a book, Beyond the River Sambation, which discusses about how he traveled to Japan, and he got to know the communities that were hidden back there who believed that they were Jews, and ultimately how the DNA evidence went against them, and how he at the end decides that they probably were not from the Ten Shvatim. What? I mean, there are different theories. I am not familiar with any river that runs 6 days a week. So I cannot tell you that we have decided that. Okay, thank you very much.